So we are on lesson 5, and we will do both chapter 28, which was from last week, and the rest of Job's testimony. And you notice that this is the end of Job's testimony. Remember, we're in a new case here, right? The first case is closed. The second case is now begun. And this case is Job against God, right? I wanted a review, but I decided, as I look at our review, it becomes a little tedious after a while because it's so long. And I decided we need to make it really simple and just take out a point of since the whole book of Job is about learning how to think rightly about God, then what are we thinking about God as we go through each chapter? So that's how I'm going to do the review from here on in. I think I'm going to just choose one thing that we've talked about when we've examined each section of the trial and the narrative and things. So, from Genesis. Remember, we always begin with Genesis. Genesis is the basic foundation of God's story. You always start at the beginning. You never know someone really well until you know the beginning of their story, right? I mean, one of the most fun things I ever did with someone who I was becoming friends with is she didn't grow up here, but she said, you know, there's a place here that seems like home to me. I want to take you to that place so you kind of get the understanding of where I come from. And so the reverse was I took her to where I grew up. So I drove her out to Dalton, and I passed our house, where I went to church, all of these different places. And for both of us, it gave us this, it just expanded my view, right, of who you are. And gave some definition for it. So for God's story, remembering this is always God's story, one of the things I always warn us as we study the word is, despite the fact that we have treated the Bible as a self-help book for years, it is not. That's not what it is. It's God's story. I mean, think about it. If you wrote your own story and you gave it to your family members and they said, oh good, now we'll know how to cook, and now we'll know how to, it's not the point. The point is God's telling his story so that he can reveal himself to us so that we want to be in relationship with him. So remembering that, we always start with Genesis. That was kind of a long answer to why we start with Genesis. So from Genesis, we've learned that God is for us. Remember that he has an outward mindset, that invites us to share that outward mindset. That idea, that perichoretic nature, God is for us. From the construct of Job, we've learned that God desires us to examine our thoughts. And I want to just explain that, why I've gone that place. Remembering that Job is a construct, it means that God so cares about what we think and what we think about him that he is willing to put his reputation on the line by inspiring an author to provide a thought experiment. Because think about it, especially for those of you who read it as literal, it sure doesn't make God come out very good, right? That God uses Satan to punish us, or that he uses even Job in a way that is not very constructive. But the fact is, God so cares about how we think that he's willing to go out on a limb and say, okay, I'm going to put this thought experiment out there, knowing that there will be a time in history that even his people will not understand it and go, oh, this is how God acts. And God uses Satan to play with us. He's willing to do that because he so cares about about what we think. He really does care about what we think. I think so many times in the church, we really consider theology to be, it belongs in
the church,
the universities, or in the pastorships. And yet, right here, with the idea that Job has been written for the purpose of us getting our thinking right, it tells us our theology is actually very important. It will determine how we see life, how we see God, how we see others, how we see our circumstances. Whether you think you have a theology or not,
you do,
and it really matters. So the fact that God is willing to do this in a story tells us a couple things about God. He really appreciates how we're made. He, by giving us Job, is doing what Nathan did to David, right? when David has sinned and Nathan needs to tell him, you are in the wrong here and you need to change, what does Nathan do to him? He tells him a story. He makes it so that David can see how wrong that is, right? Because if Nathan would have come to David and said, David, king, my king, you've done wrong, David would say, get out of here, right? But Nathan says, David, there is this situation here. And David will, well, that's wrong. Somebody shouldn't do that. And then Nathan can say, that person is you. So now there's this, oh, this is what God is doing with Job for us. He's acting like Nathan. The word Nathan, by the way, means to give. So he's giving us this construct, this story, so that we begin to see, wow, the friends are thinking wrongly, Job is thinking wrongly, there's a problem here. And yet, underneath it, I hope that as you've read some of this, you've gone, well, yeah, that's right, to either the friends or Job at some point or another. And then you begin to realize, oh, I'm just like Job. And sometimes I'm just like the friends. And so this is a gift that God given us. And he's willing to put his reputation on the line so that we will examine our thoughts. So from the idea that Job is a construct, we get to have, we know that God desires us to examine our thinking. From examining theology, we've learned that God cannot be defined by systems, right? Not by the great semiosis, nor by the retribution principle. And although those sound like ancient systems, they are systems that are employed today, right? The great semiosis is what we would collectively say is the world's way of thinking, and the retribution principle is the church's way of thinking. But we've used it as a system, and now we've boxed God into a system. And God can't be defined by a system. We tend to take instructions that God has given us to say you're valued, and if you want to live as if someone who is valued, this is a good way. We've taken those and said, oh, it's a system by which we can define life and define God. Doesn't work that way. Systems, we like systems, right? Because it gives us boundaries. It gives us black and white. Here's what I need to do. Here's what I don't need to do. It makes us feel safe and in control. The problem with systems is we don't need relationships for them. We just take a system and we just match our life to that and we're good to go. And therefore, if you make whatever God's given you as instruction to live as a valuable person, you make that into a system, you've removed it from the relationship, and that becomes a problem. So from examining theology, we realize that God cannot be defined by systems. When we examined hope, we find that God cannot be evaluated by our pictures of God. We can't choose one of his attributes and put it in a hierarchy based on our own personal needs or desires, and then use that as a standard to which to call God out, to call God good or not. We can't just choose our favorite attributes and say this is how God should act all the time, and he should only act in love. Of course, then we also define love. So we have we have pictures upon pictures upon pictures, but God cannot be evaluated by our picture of him. When we examined last week power, we found that God's power is purposefully directed by wisdom. The stirring up of the sea in Job's little poem there precipitated the chaos creature Rahab's demise, right? And do you remember what Rahab stood for? Not just chaos creature, but also, and this is really important because throughout we need to understand what's going on here. So Rahab is considered Egypt, but also arrogance, pride. So knowing that Rahab is Egypt, and for us, as Christians reading backwards, whenever we see Egypt portrayed, Egypt is always portrayed as the world systems. So that's a New Testament understanding of Egypt. And then Rahab is also considered a euphemism for pride, for arrogance, for acting independently. You know best. So all of that, God's using his power to stir up the seas in order that Rahab, whether it be Egypt, the world systems, or arrogance and pride acting as independence, which is really what Egypt was significant for, that is considered an act of creation, which is good. So that's part of God creating, ordering, is getting out, exposing, and then extracting Rahab, exposing and extracting independence. That's part of God creating, of God ordering life for good. Why would that be? Why would that be an act of creation?
It's making space.
It's making space for
relationship with God.
That's exactly what it's doing. And so it's an act of ordering. It's an act of creation. Does that make sense? I see a lot of, like, furrowed brows.
Yeah. Was Rahab a harlot in the New Testament?
Actually, in Joshua.
In Joshua.
Yes. And, of course, I don't want to get into that, but that's when we have names in the Old Testament and in the New, there's significance for that, right? We're showing Rahab, pride, Egypt, independence, can actually be brought out and redeemed, right? So you got all these things. We haven't talked about the names in Job. Maybe I'll tell you at least Job's name today. But all names have great significance. And so that's why they're calling Rahab in there. And that's unfortunate because we always then think about Rahab as Rahab the prostitute who was saved in Jericho.
But she made space, too.
But she made space, right? And that's why there's a redemption, right? There's the ability to redeem pride and arrogance, which does go along with Job, right? Because that's what happens with Job, right? So God exposes Job's arrogance, which is what happens today. Today it comes out very, very clearly. And then he'll redeem that, right? So God's power is purposely directed by wisdom to expose, to extract. We also then need to separate reason from purpose. And I think this is really difficult for us, right? We tend to think they're the same. Reason is the past cause. What has brought the stirring up? Why did it happen? But that's reason is really not very important. And I'm going to show you an example in a minute. The future good that can come out of it is the purpose. So reason always talks about past cause, and purpose is future good. That's the difference. And they are separate. They are not the same. God's purpose is always good. It's always for creation, or we would say re-creation. It's always leading to the sharing of his ever-growing perichoretic life. Always, 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 always. There is no absolute exceptions. It is always good for that. I've had for a year this tangled, there's two necklaces in here, tangled. Mm-hmm. It started with about 10 necklaces tangled all up. The reason the necklaces are tangled is because they used to hang on a bar, a jewelry rack, that got knocked off and fell on the floor. That was the cause of them getting tangled. My need to pull these apart means I'm going to, and Bill's worked on this for a long time, and he finally gave up. Means,
you know, we all want to do it.
Oh, I know. I'm hoping somebody will.
There you go.
The tugging and the pulling. When you're untangling something like this, it doesn't just involve tugging, right? There's going to be some pulling. There's also going to be like, here's a piece, and I'm just going to let it go for a minute and work on this piece. So there's some ignoring, right, of that. Mm-hmm. There's going to be some really tough places. There might eventually become, I think this is where, when I said to Bill, you're done, when he said, you know, we just need to cut it, right? Sometimes you do, right? Think about when your kids, if you had kids, your girls were young and they had the tangled, they got gum in their hair, right? Sometimes it came to, you got to cut it, right? So sometimes that happens. But the purpose of my tugging and perhaps cutting and ignoring for a while some of the change is for what?
Good.
It's for good, so that they can, it's for order, so that it can be used for what it was meant to be used for, so I can wear it again. And this is actually an important necklace for me. It's a snowflake that when my mom was dying, remember, she was not a believer. I can't even tell you the whole story, but on December 3rd, it just started snowing, and she accepted Christ a month before she died. And so my sister bought us all snowflakes to remind us of that. So it's a beautiful story. But that's special to me, right? I really like that, and it's frustrating that it's still tangled there. But here's the thing: is the reason that this is tangled, the reason that I need to pull at it and poke at it and perhaps cut it, is the reason important? It actually doesn't matter at all. I could have told you anything. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how it got tangled.
Right.
What matters is that it's the pulling and tugging is the only way it's going to have good come out of it, right? Mm-hmm. So reason is really not important. We just hold on to reason so much, but it really doesn't matter how it got tangled. The only way it would matter is, and this is true, I don't use that thing anymore. Because it was so easy to knock over. So I don't use that anymore. So it did teach me, you know, that's probably not a good system to put your necklaces on. But
you can't rely on systems.
That's right, you can't rely on systems. So does that make it clear to you, reason and purpose? Reason really doesn't matter all that much. It's very unimportant, but purpose, why the pulling and tugging? Because I want to be able to use it again for what it was made for. Now, it has sat here for a year, so I am going to, if you want to, I can feel these people. So, when we talk about God having purpose in everything, think about that. The tangling is done, however it got there. Whether it got there because of the fall of the whole earth or your own sin, big sin, little sin, doesn't really matter.
It's all sin.
It's all sin. And it's tangled. Here's the problem is it's tangled. It's disordered. But God wants to make sure that it's useful again, right? That your life is useful again. And so he's going to, and he'll be willing to pull, and sometimes he'll be willing to cut. So all of that. That's what we learn from the idea that God's power is purposely driven by wisdom. He knows what he's doing. So today we're going to examine wisdom then. We're going to look at that chapter 28 on wisdom. Again, remembering that this chapter is a recess. It's the narrator now. It's almost, when I read Job, I literally picture a reporter. You know, so there's been a courtroom, it's adjourned, and they're saying, the judge said, we're going to adjourn for a recess because we're going to bring Job's new case in. And you know how everyone files out into the hallways, but then there's always this reporter, right? And he's going to sum up everything for you, right? That's kind of what's happening here. The narrator is summing up and basically saying, all these people who said they're wise, they really don't know what they're talking about. Let me tell you what wisdom is. And that's where chapter 28 comes in. And when you know that, it kind of gives this overall, oh, now we finally have an answer. This is kind of what wisdom is, and this is where we're going to go from here. So we need to define wisdom. And that's a really difficult job because there's lots of words for wisdom, knowledge, understanding. So I'm going to give you a conglomerate. I'm going to tell you some of the Hebrew words and some of the Greek words, but then I'm going to give you this composite that I think would help us. So Hebrew is chachma. I think it's chokmah. I always forget that. Chokmah. Is the practice, what, spell it?
Yeah.
Well, it's always a transliteration. So in English, if I spell it, it would be C-H-O-K-M-A-H. C-H-O-K-M-A-H.
Thank you.
That's Hebrew?
That's
Hebrew. Yeah. It's the practiced principles for living which brings order and coherence to life. The practiced principles for living which bring order and coherence to life. Now, if we're talking about wisdom in the Greek, we're going to use two words. We're going to use Sophia, which most of you know, but also the word petronesis, which is understanding, interpretation. So it's they're synonyms. And that is the ability to discern the results of one's actions in advance.
Ooh, yeah.
The ability to discern the results of one's actions in advance. We'll get there. That's not the definition of it. So here's the expanded definition. Petronesis is the petronesis. P-I-T-R-O-N-E-S-I-S. So here's how I would give the expanded definition. We put all of the Hebrews and Greeks together. Insight into the true nature of things, which give the ability to know how to act in order to live well relationally. Yep. Insight into the true nature of things, which gives the ability to know how to act in order to live well relationally. So when we talk about wisdom, we're always referring to something that belongs to God and is given by God. And we're going to delve deeper into that a little bit. So chapter 28 is pretty fascinating. I love the metaphors that the narrator uses here. That first section, 1 from 11, really talks about the value. And what he does is he starts to take what in the A&E world would have been the most valuable thing for many reasons. So he talks about mining, right? And he's talking about mining two things, precious metals and precious gems. In the A&E world, the discovery that there were mineral deposits within the rocks and that they actually came up with technology for extracting the minerals. Now think about this, because we're very arrogant about this, right? We think we have made all the wonderful technologies. They actually came up with the technology during the A&E times to actually extract minerals and gems out of the rocks. Guys, that's amazing. Have you ever seen a rock with minerals in it or a vein of gold in it? How would you ever think of extracting that? But not only did they come up with the technology to extract it out of the rock, they also came up with techniques to be able to polish it and to be able to use it, right, in different ways. All of that, those techniques for refining it, making it useful, actually evoked awe in them. Think about it. It should evoke awe in us even today. Wow, to find something so intrinsically connected to rock and then take it out of the rock and make it brilliant, all for the use of someone's personal owning of beauty, right? Because minerals and the beautiful rocks, golds, those were all used to enhance somebody's reputation, right? Still today. Right?
Yeah.
When you know, one of the things, when you're my age, what happens when you get to be around 50, for some reason in this culture, the big thing I've noticed is people getting new diamond rings, right? So that's a big thing, and that becomes a big thing that people have new diamond rings. But even if you don't have big diamonds, we still do the rock thing, the extracting the minerals and refining them and making pretty. It says something about our status, right? Mm-hmm. So how many of you have granite countertops? Yeah. Right, that's all the thing, right, to have granite countertops, because that says you know what you're talking about. You've got something good, right? I mean, if you watch any of the house shows, the first thing that happens is they walk in, they go, there's no granite countertops. But that's the idea, is it's still the same. There, we have awe in that we can extract beautiful things for ownership to actually enhance our own status. So for A&E, that would have, he uses that to say, look, we can do this with minerals and gems, and we're pretty much in awe of that. So what the narrator does is he's using mining of these things to help us understand that humans attempt to understand the workings of the world and extract the workings of the world and the beauty of the world for our own purposes, right? So that we can own them, so that we can have them, so that our status is increased.
I'm wearing an example. This is raw amber, and this is polished amber that I got in Lithuania.
So, yes, and you're using it to enhance yourself. Right.
Well, it also has properties in it that's supposed to have healing properties within the stone.
Yep.
That's what you believe.
Again, it's about
helping
us. Right? Us. Yes, yeah. It's about us. The narrator says such awe can't be compared to the awe of what wisdom does in our lives. Wisdom's role in the world is much more important than gems or minerals. And its role isn't for the purpose of making some superior to others. Wisdom isn't for the purpose of enhancing our status. And if you think, it's interesting that the narrator does that and says that, because what has just happened in the trial before? Right? These are the most wise people, and they just keep on expounding how wise they are. And of course, now, afterwards, we're going to have Job doing that. And so he's trying to say, we're thinking about wisdom all wrong. It's much more valuable than gems and stone, and it's not for the purpose of enhancing our status. That's not what wisdom is for. So then he goes on to say the search for wisdom. So from 12 to 19, he's going to tell us that it is unattainable by human effort. We can't go searching for it like minerals or diamonds. It is possible through hard work to search and find precious metals. How many of you have ever gone gold panning? I mean, how much gold did you bring home?
Yeah,
yeah, right. If you did, it was this little dust in a little, little tube, right? It's also possible, though difficult, to discover the source of rivers. He talks about the source of rivers, right? How many of you have climbed, following the path of a waterfall to find its source? How hard was it?
Very hard.
Really hard. It's really hard. It's a lot of climbing. And you were able to find it. But wisdom cannot be found, no matter from whether people with whether human has a great effort, whether I say, okay, I'm going to do the hardest thing in my life ever, I still cannot find wisdom. I can't find it by human ingenuity. Wisdom is inaccessible from a human vantage. So he keeps on comparing these things, comparing the value, now comparing the search for the source of things, or the search for gold or gems. And then finally he says, in 19 through 28, the source is God alone. But here he changes the question. The question was, where can wisdom be found? And all of a sudden we realize, well, it's more valuable than gold and granite, but I can't find it here on earth. I can't just go look for it. I can't put a lot of effort and find it. So he changes the question to, then where does wisdom come from? So what is its source? Not where can I find it? So he's saying, you got to give up that search for finding wisdom and ask, where does it come from? What that does is it reminds us first that we're not in control of wisdom. We can't determine the time or the place of encountering wisdom. And also that we will be on the receiving end of wisdom if we're going to have any part of it, which means we're going to have to wait. Ooh, there's that word wait again, right? That keeps on coming up. The earth, in his description here, the earth, all the mining analogy, has already come up empty. Couldn't find wisdom, looking for it there. And then he says, well, we'll go to death and destruction, which is this, well, we'll go outside of the earth and find. Nope, still couldn't find it because death and destruction say they can't find it either. So the source we find, of course, is God. God is the source. So I'm gonna take a risk here and dive into a little bit of esoteric thinking. If you don't understand it, that's fine. We'll just keep going. I'm still like, ooh, this is so soft that it's very difficult to think about. I hope I can give you some examples that give you an idea. So what we know about wisdom is that God birthed wisdom. And he birthed it at the beginning of time in the decisions that he made in ordering the world, as he first began to order the world. So he says that God knows the path to wisdom. God knows the place it dwells. God saw it in the primordial past. So he saw it. He viewed it. He birthed it. This is a difficult. He made it the basis for his creative work. So before creation, there's nothing for God to provide coherence. Right? Because coherence means it talks about a relationship between things, right? One thing makes sense out of coming out of the other. Order implies a relationship of things. And before he ordered the earth, there wasn't anything to order. Therefore, there was no need for wisdom. Yeah, all of a sudden you're like, oh, wait a second, that seems weird. And yet, when he decided to order the world for the purpose of relationship with us, when he decided to do that, he birthed wisdom so that in ordering, it would be it would result in good. It would result in space for us to relate with him. So that's when he birthed wisdom. That's when he needed it. In other words, if I don't have a house and furniture, I will never need to order my house, right? Because I don't have one. But the minute I buy a house and buy furniture, now I have to go about the job of ordering it, right? And I'm going to need to have some idea about how living is going to happen. So think about that. You buy a house, you buy furniture, and now in order to place the furniture in the right places, I have to think about how I'm going to live in that house, right? So I'm going to need some idea about how I'm going to live. That's the same kind of thing God is doing at creation. He's going to need an order, and he wants to know how man he wants to make sure that man and he can live together. So he's thinking beyond what has happened yet, which is what we do when we do a house, right? I don't just say to the movers, bring it in and just put it anywhere you want. Mm-hmm. I go, okay, we're going to sleep upstairs. So I'm going to put beds upstairs. We're going to read downstairs in this room. And so I'm going to put the comfortable couches and chairs here. I'm thinking about what we're going to do. And therefore, I use my very limited wisdom as to how life will work best, right? And that's how I place the things. So that's what God births wisdom when he begins to think about. And of course, all of this is talking so that we can understand it, because God, of course, didn't have a time. He's not thinking, oh, what should I do now? But it's giving you an idea of birthing wisdom. So that God is not wisdom, And it's not that he has wisdom, it's that wisdom emanates from him. So, the inaccessibility of wisdom is because it's related to a place in time rather than space. In other words, we can't go back to that time when God began to order the world in order to access wisdom, right? We can't go back in time. It's like saying, I want to experience what the human connection was between my parents that birthed me. Can I ever actually know that? I think I can know, kind of, if because I could say, well, I know biology, so I know exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. And when you think about it, you can't even know exactly that. You can't even know the physical actions, right? But then you can say, well, I know the relationship my parents have, so I know what it was probably like to experience their connection when they birthed me, right? When they first, our birthing process is from conception to the 9 months later. The only thing I can do in experiencing the connection that created me, that birthed me, is to participate in a derivation of it, right? What I experience now, what I know my parents now, and I can derive from that some of the feeling of what it was like to have that connection birth me. Does that give you any sense? And if not, fine, set it aside. Not necessary for you to know.
I think once you have your own child, though, that helps give you a better idea of what happened, maybe.
But does it?
No.
You have no idea.
I even forget what it was like for me and my husband.
There you go.
Parents. Yeah. I have no idea, but...
It could be. It could be totally different. Yeah. What happens is we begin to assume we know.
Right.
And I've actually done that. I remember. I don't remember what we were teaching. But I used as an analogy. Oh, that wonderful time of courtship. You know, when we all it was so great. And I had someone come up to me after class and say, you know, all of our courtships weren't like that. Mine was horrible. And it just made me realize, whoa, I assumed. Mm-hmm. I assumed this was my experience, so it must be everyone's experience. And that's the thing with wisdom is we've got to be careful about assuming because we can never go back to that point when God birthed wisdom. That's all you really need to know is you can never obtain the wisdom. As we go farther, I think you'll understand that a little bit more. Job and his friends think they know what wisdom is and that they can own it, that they can obtain it, they can find it, and they can have it for themselves and own it, and then give it out to others. And they think wisdom is found in the order of the RP, right? They think wisdom is found in justice being the foundation. And of course, we know they're wrong. But they are absolutely convinced that's where wisdom is found, in the RP, with justice at the top. But in truth, there's no foundational principle that runs the world. And that really messes up our, what do you mean there's no foundational principle that runs the world? Why not? What runs the world?
God.
God runs the world. And we almost want to argue with, well, yeah, but he does it by foundational principles. No, he doesn't. God runs the world. And he uses his wisdom to make sure that it goes in an order so that it will come to good. So that's where we have to be careful about thinking that we can obtain wisdom and how Job and his friends kind of get skewed. We also get skewed. So, we've talked about the source of wisdom. We've talked about the search for wisdom. We've talked about the value of wisdom. So if we can't own wisdom for ourselves, we can't take it, what then can we do about wisdom? And then we have God speaking. The very end of Job 28:28, it's God speaking. And he says, I'm giving you an invitation. And the invitation is to fear the Lord. Fear the Lord is wisdom. So we've already seen in this chapter that the sea, the deep, destruction, death, they've all had their say. They confess to not knowing anything about wisdom. They don't know where to find it, how to get it. God says, look, I'm the one who birthed wisdom. I've evaluated it. I've assessed it. I've used it. And I am the one who concludes what humans can do to participate in wisdom. And so he says, here's how you participate in wisdom. So we're going to go just a little by little just with this verse, the fear. So we know at the very beginning of Job that it says Job feared God, right? But remember to watch your vocabulary. Job feared Elohim, right? The generic for God, which is the big picture of God. His actions demonstrated that he feared God because he was very conscientious in his rituals, in his prayers. His testimonies, his words, say he thinks God is powerful. But we're beginning to see in Job, he thinks God is powerful, but he's not always doing the right thing. He's deficient in some ways. So his fear of God is not big enough to actually encompass God being able to know what he's doing. So the fear of God means he knows God's powerful. He respects that fear. Fear of God speaks to how we think about God. We recognize his power to act, which is much more than our power, and we take that ability seriously. Job took God's power seriously. He wouldn't be arguing with him if he didn't, right? He knows that God's power is the power that has caused all of these things to happen to him. So he absolutely takes God's power seriously. But God is saying, the fear of the Lord is wisdom. Different word here. Not Elohim, but Adonai. This is the only time Adonai is used in Job. It's the only time in the whole Bible that God himself says of himself that he is Adonai. Sometimes he will use Adonai Elohim, Adonai Yahweh, but this is the only time he uses this. So, if fear of God is a recognition of God as powerful, which will be manifested in conscientious observance of doing the right thing, because I know God is powerful, we get to then what difference does it make from fearing God to from fearing Elohim to fearing Adonai. Elohim is general. Adonai is a more
intimate.
I'm not going to use intimate yet because Adonai isn't really intimate, but it's getting there, right? It's not Yahweh yet. So we have Elohim, general. We have Adonai. We'll talk about Adonai in a minute. And then we have Elohim. It's a continuum, right? And so he's saying, you need to fear God as Elohim, but you also need to fear God as Adonai. Adonai means Lord or Master, which speaks of the need for submission. Now, Job so far is lacking in submission to Adonai. He's feared God. He respects his power. He understands that his power is bigger than his. But he needs to grow in his understanding of who God is. Fearing the Lord is a recognition of God as wise. It means we take seriously not only that he's powerful, but he's the author of coherence. He knows how life works and how everything fits together to make sense, to be good, since it is by his wisdom that he ordered all things. Does this make sense to you? Knowing wisdom is inaccessible to humans, except through God, the source, means it's going to be a participation meal. We'll expand that in just a second. Fearing Adonai, fearing the Lord, will be manifested by submission, which means understanding how things work is not the issue. It's not what we're to be concerned with. It is trusting in the face of not understanding. That's the issue. That's what it means to fear the Lord, to fear Adonai. Trusting in the face of not understanding how things are making sense. And if I trust God in the face of things of not understanding, it means I trust him not to be all the things that Job is accused of: detached, incompetent, limited, corrupt, short-sighted, petty. So that when I fear the Lord, I submit to knowing he knows what's going on. I don't need to. Which is why I asked you the question at the very beginning, right? How many electrical appliances would you be able to fix? You use all of those appliances in your house, right? Every one of you has a refrigerator. Every one of you, what are your other electric appliances? Some of you have electric stoves. Dishwasher.
Yes.
Washing machine. Dryer.
Toaster.
All these things. You use all of those, right?
Yes.
And you don't sit there and go, now I am not going to be able to use this until I understand how it works. Right. Until I know I could fix it, I'm not using it.
Plug it in and turn it on.
Right? That's it. And we have no problem with that. I don't care that I don't know how to fix it. Part of mine is because my husband can fix it all. So I have no problem. And yet, even if Bill knew how to fix nothing, I would still use my refrigerator every day. And I would never go, I can't believe I'm using this. I don't know how it works. This I shouldn't, right? I don't. And yet, when it comes to things in life, when we don't understand it, I mean, I've heard many people say, as long as I understand what's going on, I'm good. But really, we can't live like that.
How does Wi-Fi work?
I mean, we can pick lots of things, right? All over the things. So for us to
you understand your husband has more knowledge than you, and you just trust him to take care of that.
I do.
It's the same thing with God.
Yes.
We understand he has more knowledge than we have. He knows everything that's going on. He knows what the plan is. He knows what the future is.
Yes.
Why is it such a problem to trust them?
Yes, exactly. And that's a good question, right, Pat? When we're sitting here not in crises. But my guess is, I mean, Susan, how have you been feeling in the last 6 months? Are there times where it's just really difficult to trust that God knows what he's doing?
Very hard to trust. Mm-hmm.
And this is the problem with Job, is Job is not a place where you go, okay, oh, you're in crisis? Let's sit down and just see this. It is something that you use to prepare for crisis, so that your thinking really needs to be prepared for crisis, so that when you get into crisis, it's not, you can be a little more stable.
I know.
I have always been concerned, okay, how's Susan going to work with this? But of course, God also knows that as well. So, manifested by trusting in the face of non-understanding. That's the fear of the Lord. And then he says, the fear of the Lord is wisdom. Now, remember how many times we've talked about definite articles. So you get lots of English classes here. What's a definite article?
The.
A is a definite article. When he's talking about wisdom in chapter 28, up until this verse, it's always with a definite article. It always says the wisdom. And then here it says just wisdom. So when God gives advice about wisdom to humanity, the word has no definite article. The wisdom that humanity is able to participate in is not the wisdom. It is not the ultimate wisdom. It is not God's wisdom. And even that is not correct syntactically. It's not the ultimate wisdom that we participate in, that we have. It is a derivative of that. So just like I talked about, you can only experience what kind of a connection birthed you by experiencing how your parents relate now? That's a derivative of that original connection, right? I can only access a derivative of the ultimate wisdom, of the wisdom that actually runs everything. I can never go back to that point. I can never experience that. I can't experience the wisdom that God uses in how he makes things cohesive. But I can actually have a way of participating in that wisdom. So, in other words, when you think about wisdom, it's not like trick-or-treat candy. It's not like you knock on the door of heaven and you say to God, I'd like some wisdom. And he puts it in your bag and you take it and you go off by yourself and now I get to use it. Depending on how you, whatever you did with your little wisdom candy, you sat on the floor and you separate and you go, I have this and this. But it's all by yourself, right? It's almost this. It's almost the best picture of hoarding, right? Isn't it? You kind of, it's almost like when I picture it, it's always the scurrying. Now, I have to tell you, I loved Halloween as a kid. I loved Halloween as a parent. I dragged my kids block after block when they would say, let's go home. And I'd say, you don't have enough. Just one of those things. But that picture of being able to knock on the door and say, God, I'd like some wisdom, and him putting it in your bag, and you get to take it, and now it's yours, and you get to, like, hoard it, and now it's mine, I can use it. That's not how wisdom works. Wisdom is actually a participatory meal. The only way you can have wisdom is actually coming to a meal that God has invited you to, and you share it with him. He's prepared it, and you actually get to eat it with him. It's the only way that wisdom is actually able to have any part of you, is that you get to be connected. Wisdom is inherently connected to him. It never leaves him, and you can't just take it and own it for yourself. Does this make sense to you?
Is it almost like experience, like an experiential relation? I mean, experiencing God.
That right, it can never be used. You can never have it apart from God. It can only be in his presence, right? You can't, and you never take home a doggy bag from that meal, right? It's only in that time that you're experiencing it with him. You participate in it, but you don't own it. It's codependent on his wisdom.
So when Solomon asks, it's not a doggy bag. Like, he's just, be closer to me. Work a meal.
Yep.
You're going to do this with me.
Exactly. Exactly.
So when I finish that meal, and a child asks for my advice, and it's godly advice, is that wisdom?
Yeah, so think about when you actually leave a meal. When you leave a meal, what are you bringing with you? The experience, but the energy that will come out of it, right? Because you've consumed energy. And you have that energy to be able to expend for a while. But you couldn't take the meal in a doggy bag and bring it home. It's like the manna, right? Yeah. I can't take it and like hoard it for what I want to use it for. It's energy to actually enhance who I am, which is an image bearer. Does that make sense?
That's very
helpful. Okay. What?
You are what you eat.
You are what you eat, exactly, exactly. And who you eat it with. When we respond to God with the assumption that he's wise, that he knows what he's doing, then we fear Adonai. And thus we open up the path to let him feed us wisdom. I know you're wise. I'm going to sit down with that meal. So let's go back to Genesis, Adam and Eve. When the serpent challenged God's policy, like Hasatan did in Genesis 3, the policy about not eating the tree of wisdom, right? The tree of the knowledge of good and evil, wisdom. God was giving them space to learn to trust him as Adonai. Not to understand how keeping this particular food away from them was good, but to trust God's wisdom that he knows what he's doing, and it can be counted on to let us participate in his wisdom meal when it is time. So in Genesis 3, when we have God saying, do not eat from this, It is not because he never intends to let them eat. It's that it has to be eaten as a meal that he gives them. You have to wait to be fed it. And it is in his wisdom that he gives Adam and Eve the space to say, can you trust me that I know what I'm doing by keeping it from you for now? Instead, they looked at it as the trick-or-treat wisdom. Oh, I can just take this for myself and go use it for myself apart from him.
Really expands the Eucharist, you know?
Yes.
I mean, it's really...
Doesn't it?
Wow. I'll look at that.
So differently.
Mm-hmm. Well, and just how God knows our character.
Yes.
You know, if we have this experience with him and, you know, the Holy Spirit is just inside us, and the next day, you're a whole different person.
Yes, yes. So, yeah, and Raman, I like that you bring up the Eucharist too. Particularly, think about from old, Eucharist used to be taken every day. Mm-hmm. Some churches we do every week. And then some churches we've gone to once a month.
Yeah.
Or once a quarter. Really? Once a quarter?
Yeah. I don't know if ours does once a quarter.
The idea that we need to be in a participation meal with God in order to have any experience of any energy that comes from his wisdom of knowing how to live well relationally. We need to be able to be in that presence. So, to fear the Lord is wisdom, and turning from evil is understanding. That's how submission is manifested, right? By turning from evil. And what do we always say evil is?
Independence.
Evil is independence. So this is one of those, if this isn't your thinking yet, this is one of those thinkings that you have to practice for 21 days. Evil is not behavior. Evil is independence. Rahab. It's exposing that Rahab, that evil that's in there. And we can talk about it being an inward mindset. An inward mindset is independence. Job has already been described as this, right, from turning from evil. But he's only done so when he knows what's going on, when he gets it, when life makes sense to him, right? Then he has turned away from evil. But we're noticing, particularly in the next chapter, he is not turning away from evil there. He has not turned away from evil in situations where he doesn't understand what's going on, where things aren't coherent to him, that things don't make sense to him. What does that look like practically? In suffering, don't expect it all to make sense. God, despite the fact that he's revealed himself to us, remains mysterious and paradoxical. The world, although it's under his control, is disordered, and it is in the midst of redemption, and it's going to feel more chaotic than cohesive and coherent. So our experience will often evade consistent coherence. Trust God that he knows what he's doing. Our confidence is not that there's an explanation for everything, but that God knows what he's doing. Trust God rather than blame him or make demands for explanations. Trust God for strength to endure, to wait and see the good that comes out. Trust God rather than blame him or make demands for expectations or for explanations. Trust God so you make space for him to connect more of his life to your rough edges. Trust God so that you make space for him to connect more of his life to your rough edges. I'll give you an example of that in just a few minutes. Thirdly, know it will be a battle in your mind, That's what we've been talking all about. It's why we have Job, is to think about what we're thinking about. Because it requires us to accept what seems like a paradox, and our minds don't like paradoxes, so we'll struggle with that. But if we allow a cycle of flawed thoughts of God, that will win over and lead us to despair. Remember, when you're in suffering, the battle isn't against pain and suffering. It's against static living. God is wanting to extract, wanting to make sure that we have as much edges that can connect with him as possible. And so he's making those edges for us so that we can grow, right? If you're not growing, you're not living. It is all about growth in his pericritic life. I'll make that a little clearer as we go on.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
It was in the homework too. Why is there the difference in the Psalms and Proverbs? The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom versus here it just says the fear of the Lord is wisdom. I didn't really know why.
Yeah, I wish I was going to cover that. Let me think about that and remember what the difference is and why I put that in your homework.
Okay.
Let me think about that.
Okay.
We get to 29 through 31, and this is Job's defense, right? Remember, now this is a new lawsuit. Job has brought a lawsuit against God. And now Job is standing up, and he's his own lawyer, and he's going to defend himself, and he's just going to make one long speech. And then he's going to be done. So that's what this is. And when we do this, when we look at Job's speech, what we're examining is integrity. And integrity is the same as coherence, right? Because integrity means everything fits together, right? My motives, my actions, and my words all are cohesive. So coherence, integrity, same. If fearing the Lord means we recognize God as the author of coherence, then we'll give God the benefit of the doubt in the midst of perceived incoherence. We come to recognize that just because we don't see things as making sense, not working together, doesn't mean that God doesn't know what he's doing. It just means we don't see everything, right? Just because we don't see it doesn't mean it isn't true. We could think about a million things in our life that we can't see but we know are true. Job's previous testimonies have already told us what he thinks about coherence. He thinks coherence is found in justice. As long as justice is running the world, everything makes sense to him. I would say that that's pretty similar to most of how we think. As long as everything's just, things make sense. They also, because of that, they believe that they can know wisdom, that they can know the path to wisdom and how wisdom takes shape, and that they can possess it on their own. So that's where they're coming from. In chapter 29, Job is going to recount the coherence of the past, how the past made sense to him. And notice, this whole chapter, he only mentions God once. You should have noticed Job's whole... his whole situation and how he feels has gone way downhill. He began up here, and he just keeps going down and down, and this is the bottom. So we're at that point where Job is just so concerned about himself and so thinking about himself. And as I was looking at this outline, I realized, oh, wait a second, this is exactly what we taught in Lesson Zero. This is how the mind works, right? We talked about what an inward mindset looks like. That it will begin with self-betrayal. It will resist, this is from Lesson Zero, resist giving full attention to God. This is where we find Job right now, right? His attention is on himself. Self-betrayal always begins with trying to justify why we're not paying attention to God any longer. So that's self-betrayal. Because remember, if I'm an image bearer, I'm intrinsically connected to God, and I have to pay attention to God in order to continue to be all I can be as a self-image bearer.
So he feels attacked, and so he's defending himself.
Yes. But again, so did Adam and Eve, right? Mm-hmm. Because their attention wasn't on God. Mm-hmm. I can be attacked lots. If I'm paying attention to the person who's protecting me, like it doesn't really matter. But self-betrayal happens through the natural course of interruptions. And remember we talked about Genesis 3, that when the serpent comes, that's an interruption, right? It's not necessarily something bad, but it interrupts my attention. And my attention gets put on there. But my attention should get right back to God. And yet, when I don't bring my attention back to God, when that disconnection happens, and I have this shame, and this is going a lot back to Sabbath, this shame comes up. And remember, shame always signals, hey, your inattention is making you disconnected. Stop. And what do we often think shame means? Try to find another way around, right? Think about the crossing gates of a railroad, right? Lots of us, when those railroad things come down, if you go to Wheaton at all, you're always like, oh.
Go over the bridge.
Which, yeah, go over the bridge, but then there's some lights that won't let you go over. Which way can I go? So you're thinking all this way instead of stopping and waiting, right? Oh, wait, I'm not supposed to go beyond here. That's the idea of shame. That's what shame is made for. It was supposed to, it's a signal to bring us back. But when we continue to disengage, when we continue to take our attention away from God, we'll put all our attention on the interruption and give it increased importance. This is exactly what's happening with Job, right? It is increasing in importance to him, and God is decreasing in importance to him. Do you see that happening in Job? Mm. That's what's happening with him. Because of what's happening in his brain. Detachment leaves you on your own to make decisions about good and bad, right and wrong. And that detachment is self-betrayal, because that's not how we are created. From self-betrayal, we'll go to self-justification. Resisting, receiving from God an invitation for reconnection. And we'll begin to inflate our ability to make life good, and will minimize God's ability to look out for me. Oh, that's what Job's doing, right? That's what happens to all of us when we continue to keep our eyes on the crisis rather than on God. We will inflate our ability to make the right decisions, to make life good, and minimize God's ability to make life good. Remember that those kinds of thoughts, independent thoughts, thoughts of being independent, are toxic, and they shove extra chemicals into our brain, and our brain goes crazy, right? And our brain goes crazy and feels like we've got to get into that fight or flight mode. And what has Job chosen?
Fight.
He is going to fight. And it's coming from wrong thoughts, not being put to bed, not putting his inattention on God. And now he's got to fight, because now he's got to defend. And you said, Pat, he's feeling attacked, and now he's got to fight for it, right? He's got to defend himself. I won't go through all of that. So, that refusal to act on another, to focus on another, to focus on God for Job here, brings us to justification, inflating my own virtue, my own needs, and inflating the value of the things that I think value, and then minimizing others' virtues, which is always blaming, right? Seeing the other person as not paying attention to you, not meeting your needs. And finally saying, the other is a problem. That's why I'm suffering. The other is the problem, which is exactly the road that Job has taken. So we have Job's attention fixed on himself. He wallows in the nostalgia of how great his life was, and he only mentions God once. He characterizes his former state as the epitome of honor. So he's really talking about his good reputation here. So we have to understand in an honor-shame society that a person's role and status within the community define his identity. His reputation defined his identity. Now, here's an interesting thing. Where do you think that ever comes up for us? That our reputation defines our identity?
In our work?
Everyday life. Do you think we live in an honor-shame society?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. It's not always been the case, but that has changed, and you can tell by certain things that go on. Definitely, we live in an honor-shame society.
Yes.
America has not always been an honor-shame society, but we are now, and we're getting even more so. It's part of the reason that we have so much upheaval. With no matter where you are, you have all of this upheaval. Corporate identity takes precedent in an A&E honor society over individual identity. So selfhood is always shaped by social interaction, rather than your private inward perception. So instead of the idea, well, I feel good about myself, so I'm okay. It's how does society see me? And that tells me if I'm okay, right? So it's always an external thing. And you can test this many ways by whether you're being okay is whether it's internal or external. Lots of different ways if you think about what will people think if, right?
We stay quiet because we don't focus on.
Yeah, we don't want people to think otherwise, right? Yes. So self is defined by exterior terms, particularly in an honor shame society. Social coherence is essential for maintaining personal coherence. In other words, your life only makes sense if you're part in society, your reputation aligns with your motives and actions. So only your reputation. So when you think about the things that are happening in our world today, we can see more and more of this. In other words, we're going to fight for people seeing us as we want to be seen because what society says about me tells me who I am. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So this hasn't always been in America. There was a point where as long as we felt okay about ourselves, we didn't have to fight for other people seeing them, who we were. But now, because we're in an honor-shame society, full-blown, we're that way. So that's Job, right? So it's really not about how he feels about himself. It's how does the world see me that makes a difference, because how the world sees me gives me my identity and gives me the fact that I'm okay. And so I'm going to fight for that. That's why he's fighting so hard. So think about it in any other terms today. He's fighting to make sure that people see him as righteous because that's his identity. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
It's kind of like our social media.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is going on over and over.
Yeah. When was America not like that?
It's been a gradual, gradual, right? But let's say when we were first settling the country here, right?
Okay.
And of course, there's always some honor shame coming up, mm-hmm. but it wasn't pervasive. You could be a pioneer and live out. And you didn't really care that the world thought you're nuts, right? Mm-hmm. So during
those World War II, things were still better.
And I would say the wars started shifting. World War II would probably start shifting. I would love to be better at my history than I am, mm-hmm. but definitely after the wars, I would say World War II probably started. Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. Now we've got. Lots of different things.
Well, even how we chose presidents, right? Because we
yes.
didn't, like, before, I mean, who was it? Roosevelt, like, if we knew he was in a wheelchair,
right.
like, people probably wouldn't have voted, but they didn't, it wasn't about
it wasn't,
your whole identity,
right.
it was
right.
what you stood for or whatever that
right. Right.
decided.
So it began to shift a little bit more into that way, so that we embraced that. Now, throughout history of the world, it goes up and down, right? We go honor, shame, and then we do, It's not that not being an honor shame is better. It's just that's how we begin to see each other, either by how society sees us or just in our own little enclaves. Does that make sense? Okay.
But then about that time came the black people wanting equal justice, and the whites at that time, way back in the war and coming up through, I don't know, there's rocky road there.
There's never, yeah, there's never not been honor shame,
right.
But it's what's driving society more. Honor shame, definitely. Honor shame in any culture.
Right.
Then it went down, and then it went way up again in New Testament times, Roman Empire type of things. The more global the society, the more honor shame. Mm-hmm. We're very global now, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All that, I just wanted you to understand where Job is. He's fighting for this external recognition that he is a righteous person, because that's who his identity is, according to what society sees him as. And the fact that he's sitting on an ash heap says, society says you're worthless. Job has this inside relationship with God. Now, when you read that, you probably thought, oh, like we have with Jesus, you know, this personal relationship. It's not like that. This inside relationship is very different. It's a privileged status stemming from his home being close to where the divine council meets. I know this becomes so confusing. This is an AE mind thinking. I live close to where the divine council meets, so the temple, whatever that might have been for Job. He felt like he lived in a place that he could actually hear what God wanted. And that was a privilege. Not that he chose to live there, but he actually could hear. So they put it in terms of, if you live next to the White House and you got to hear, you know, these conversations, like, you know more than other people. And so now you're going to choose to act in ways that you know would be good because you know things other people don't. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. That's how Job sees, like, he's privileged to know what God wants because he lives in the vicinity of the place that he can hear God. Because he can hear God, let's see if I can, because this is going to show how he thinks everything is coherent. I don't want to get this wrong here. So he lives near God. So this is a privilege. This is a privilege that he's been granted. Because of that, he has an opportunity to hear what God wants. So he has an opportunity to listen. And because he has an opportunity to listen, he actually wants to listen to honor that privilege. So he listens to what God wants because he's honoring that privilege. His listening then compels his actions. I heard that God really wants me to take care of the vulnerable. And I was privileged to hear that God told me that. That I got to overhear that. And because of that, I feel very privileged. I'm going to do that. Right? Mm-hmm. So his motivation is very consistent. I feel it was a privilege that I got to hear this. So I want to do this. Do you understand this? Right? He's not going, oh, I'm going to get something for it. I feel it was a privilege that I got to hear this.
So is he humble?
His thinking is that he's consistent, that he has integrity, right? That he's not trying, he doesn't think it's a transaction that he's doing this. His actions compel him to do what he heard. Because his actions compel him, he continues to find blessing.
again, he doesn't think he's getting blessing because of his actions so much, but that God continues to bless him. His blessings then give him a reputation for being righteous. It all, to him, makes sense. It all lines up, right? So he gets this reputation of having a relationship with God, of being righteous, a reputation for righteousness. For having a relationship with God, which he does, right? Because his relationship is that he got to hear, so he's listening, and because he's listening, he is active, and because he's active, he continues to be blessed, because he's doing what God wants him to do, because that's how the world works. His reputation then gives him, and this is part of the Honor Shame Society, his reputation gives him a social position of honor. I always remember when I first became a Christian, I was 10 years old, and for probably 10 years after that, I always felt, if I said to people, you know I'm a Christian, I really felt like people would think, wow. I literally did. I thought that people would honor me because I said I was a Christian. It took me 10 years to figure out that isn't true. But that's in that society, absolutely he got honor because he had a reputation for being righteous. And so he had a social position of honor that people looked to him. Of course, his blessings helped his reputation, which helped his social position, right, with honor. And his social position then he used to help others. So for Job, his life makes sense, right? One thing leads to another, and for him, that would mean, since he helps others, not because he helps others, but because his life is integrated, cohesive, it would continue in his mind that he would continue to have an opportunity to have a relationship and hear God. Now, how do you get why he's so upset? It's messing up. He isn't hearing from God. He doesn't have the opportunity to have this face-to-face with God anymore. It's like God has taken away his presence. It's like God has gone, I'm moving. And it completely crumbles his whole idea of what life is like, that life makes sense. Life doesn't make sense anymore. Because now who am I? Who am I completely has been lost. It's his social status that has been lost. Is his reputation that has been lost because God has moved. Not because Job did something here. Because if here his social position he hoarded and did and ignored the poor, if that would have happened, it would also make sense. Oh well, that makes sense. He needs to get back into this position of this thing. Does that help you understand where Job is thinking? That's where Job thinks that things have gotten messed up. Like, I'm living in the right circle here, and it should end up that I continue to hear from God and have this relationship with him, of being able to hear him.
Jill?
Yes?
Could you say then that that's where these friends came in that kind of upset this whole thing with what they were saying?
Well, yeah, the friends were saying, oh, no, no, Job is a transaction. Just the friends are going, no, it's over here. It's like, you do this, he'll do that. You do this, you do that. You haven't done this, so you just got to get back to doing this. That's what the friends are saying. It's just a transaction. And Job's going, no, no, it's not a transaction. It's this being integrated with life, right? It's this idea, but it's still, both of them are still basing that the world is based on justice, right? This is justice. This is justice. Both are justice.
Life makes sense to Job until God seems to step back, right? And once he steps back, he no longer hears God. Because he doesn't hear God, he's not going to honor that privilege, right? He's not honoring that privilege anymore. He's trying to, but there's nothing to honor, and he doesn't know what to do with this. his attention is now turned on this mess things. And so in 30, he reiterates the incoherence of the present. It doesn't make sense to him any longer. And his attention returns to God, but in a negative way, which is exactly what we said happens in the brain, right? He characterizes God as a chaos creature, which is pretty interesting because at the very beginning of the whole trial, Job is mad at God for treating him like a chaos creature. And now he's saying, well, God, you're like a chaos creature because your behavior is bringing disorder into my life. Because you're refusing to act on my behalf and because your non-actions have caused me to be an outcast. Job sees God as recklessly cruel. This is the most severe accusation that Job has made. He says that he's depicting God as using his power to crush him without purpose. In charging God in bringing disorder, Job is questioning God's wisdom and basically saying, "You are the author of disorder." The first half of the book, he basically says, God, you're not good. You're not for me. This second half, Job accuses God of not being wise. You don't know what you're doing. That's why he calls him a chaos creature. You're creating havoc, and you have no purpose for it, and you don't know what you're doing. Job characterizes his current state as external shame. This is not internal shame. This is external. So don't read it in our... So we have these mixed ideas of we have this internal shame and then external shame. It's full-on external shame. His dignity's gone, and it leaves him vulnerable and disenfranchised. He is nobody because society doesn't see him as anybody. So now in 31, he demands a regaining of his coherence. He refuses to revise his focus on justice. Nope. Justice is how the world is run, or at least how it should be run. The wicked will eventually suffer. God will continue to scrutinize my actions. And considering both these things, I'm going to make an oath. And if I make a false oath, that will be worthy of punishment. Because God is paying attention and the wicked will suffer. If God doesn't act on his oath, further suffering, then Job feels he can claim vindication. What Job does here is because God isn't assuring his justice, he's going to make his own justice. He's going to take matters into his own hand, planning to use God's silence to reinstate his justice. So this is why he makes all of this oath. I'm going to be vindicated by you not doing anything about this. I'm going to tell you how good I am, and you dare try to see if you can punish me again from this, because I am good. He refuses to revise his own expectations. It's almost like he's taking a lie detector test. You know, how many shows have you watched where... I'm innocent. I'm going to take a lie detector test and show you. And so he feels like if he takes a lie detector test and sees that he is innocent completely, then it will be proven that Job is right and that God is wrong. That's what Job's doing here. He's taking matters into his own hands and he's going to use God's silence to prove that he is right and God is wrong. He's pitting his own reputation against God's reputation. And so he goes through these categories of oaths. And the interesting thing about the categories of oaths he goes through, so he goes through all these things, and you can just put them in, I'll tell you the categories in a minute. But he says, look, God, if I've done this, then punish me this way. But notice that the punishments are not equal. It's not tooth for tooth. It is, if I've done this, then punish me even worse. Punish me in the same area, but punish me worse. And if I've done this, then punish me worse in that area. And I've done this, then punish me worse in that area. He does this because he's so convinced of his innocence, right? And it will it highlights how right he is and how wrong God is. So the categories, the first one is, if I've lacked integrity of character, then make me lose all provision. This is not super important. If I were taking notes, I wouldn't put that down. It's just giving you an idea that these are the categories that he sees himself as innocent in. If I lack sexual purity, then let me lose my wife. Very graphic here, isn't he? He is trying to shock God into either saying something, vindicating him, or showing that he's right by not saying a word. If I lack compassion and charity, then let me lose the power to do so. He talks about losing my arm, losing the ability to be compassionate and show charity. If I lack trust of God, I love here because he says, if I lack trust of God, which could mean I trust my wealth or I trust other gods, very un-A&E thing to say. That's a very Israelite thing to say. Then let me lose favor with you. Well, that's interesting because he already has. Everyone thinks he has, right? If I lack grace to outsiders, strangers, or enemies, then let me lose my prosperity in order to do so. What Job is trying to do is to sand down his edges so that he, of this new rough reputation that he has, so that he makes sure that people know that he is still connected to God by producing external evidence. So think of your life as a puzzle. What's the nice thing about a puzzle? What's the best thing about a puzzle?
There's
edges, right? Yeah. Like that, doesn't that make you feel comfortable? That's how you start a puzzle. That just makes you feel good. And so I'm thinking this last night, I'm thinking, oh, okay, I'm going to use a puzzle. And so we started a puzzle last night, and we couldn't come anywhere near it. Cause
what's over there?
I weighed too long. Oh, I'll show you. So it's a puzzle of a map of here, of this neighborhood.
Oh.
So that's why it doesn't work, because I haven't finished it. But my whole family, as soon as I started puzzle, it was like, oh, let's do it. Oh. So we've all been working on that. But if you think of your life as a puzzle, you like those edges. They feel good, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, oh. I don't like that this isn't finished yet, but I know I have all the pieces and I know I can finish it, no problem. And it feels good. But what if the puzzle, what if somebody said, what if God said, you know, I want to take some of those edge pieces away.
No.
Don't want that, right? Now you're left with these raw edges, these ragged edges, right? These ragged edges feel very uncomfortable to us, feel unfinished. Like, no, that doesn't feel coherent to us, right? That doesn't make sense to us. Because he says, here you go, this is what your life is now. I want you to have a life of puzzle that your edges are ragged. What if I take away all of your edges?
It disrupts my order.
It disrupts your order, right? It makes you uncomfortable, right? It doesn't feel safe anymore. Every time I think about that, I think C.S. Lewis's best written words were, is Aslan safe? Mm-hmm. No, but he's good. That's what's happening with Job here. Job thinks safe is good. We think safe is good. We think nice straight edges are good. What Job doesn't understand, and what we don't understand in the midst of our crisis is rough edges are the only place God can connect, right? If you've got a nice bordered puzzle, can you connect with anything else? No, it's the rough edges. It's the edges that have these little things cut out of them. Those are the only place you can connect.
Are you saying because the edges are vulnerable?
Well, the edges won't attach to anything.
Yeah.
Right?
They've attached to nothing but,
Edges. When you think about,
there's nothing for it to touch.
Straight
an
line.
Edge piece. Put his piece in.
That's right.
Yeah.
What can I do? I can't. Mm-hmm. I can butt up against it, but there's no connection to that edge piece.
It doesn't fit.
Nothing fits in. And God is all about bringing us to the place where we intimately connect. here.
Yeah.
He doesn't want us to just butt up against him. He wants us to connect. And so the rough edges in our life are actually the most important places in our life.
People grab a hold of that rough edge, right?
God is the one who's going to be able to connect, right, in those edge pieces. Job doesn't understand that. These rough places are good places. These are places where my life can connect to your life, and you can actually have more of my life flowing in your life. If you want all edges, you want independence. Does that picture make sense?
That's inward.
Yeah, it's an inward mindset. Without the nice bordered edges, with all those, these edges here instead, little holes in them, those are the places, right, that God can connect with you.
But we just want to be our own puzzle.
We do. We do. It feels safe, right? It feels comfortable. I know everything that's in there. And I wish I could have finished this puzzle, because the puzzle is literally in the center is Bible Nest on. And then it's a map of this area. I love that. Like, yeah, I feel safe right in the center here. I know, you know, as you're putting the puzzle together, you go, oh, there's Hobson Road. Oh, there's Pioneer Park. You know, all these places. I feel safe and comfortable. If I don't have edges here, like, how far does this go? Well, what's the very first thing that Genesis tells us? We're made to spread out, right? Spread God's presence out. I can't spread God's presence out. Yeah, in that island type of thing. He refuses then to revise his view of God. See, when God is taking away those edge pieces of your puzzle, God is doing it for good, right? But an unanswered oath for Job, juxtaposed to his suffering, demonstrates that God's policies can't be carried out consistently. So if Job's oath stands, I'm innocent of all these things, and if you don't say anything about it, God, you're required to punish me if these are wrong. If I'm saying here in public, this is a very public statement for Job. And we know it's very public because at the end he signs it. He says, here is my signature. And he signs it and says, I want everyone to know I have not done these things. And if it's like saying, God, if I'm wrong, strike me with lightning. Mm-hmm. And nothing happens. And so Job feels vindicated. I now have my vindication in public, that God has not punished me because I've not done any of these things. And notice those categories all consist of the things that his friends have accused him of. So where is Job's flawed thinking? God can be manipulated. By trying to force God's hand, Job believes he can control God in some manner. We all have this thinking. Mm-hmm. It's the idea of a teenage boy talking to his girlfriend, if you love me.
Yeah, we all.
It's my last night.
I'm going off to war. You can tell she's dying. Janet, would you do a really quick, sorry, Janet's going to do a brain break because we still have 10 minutes to go.
So we'll do it really quick. So first, I think it'll be better to just seated because you can see the picture. So I guess just stand up, it'll make a little step down. At least the standing up thing.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. This is a pretzel, and you want to put your hands out. I'm going to have to hold this up because I think you need the visual. So you want to put your hands out, and you want to trace the pretzel. But first, do your right, let's do it with just your right hand, your hands here, and trace in the ear of the pretzel, and you want to go up and over and down. Mm-hmm. Now try to do it with your left hand. Start here, up, over, mm-hmm. down, and you know it's coming. Both at the same time. So, up, over, and then end. Like, you know. Trying to go the other way.
I think I just want to cross it.
So here's the thing.
Shouldn't they meet?
No, they cross over. They cross over.
Me. Yeah. But you gotta try to do both at the same time.
Okay. Thanks, Janet. Kind of reminded me of the perichoretic.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
I love that. Job's flawed thinking. God can be manipulated. God, if you love me, you'll restore my reputation, is what God's saying, is what Job is saying. My hardest suffering in the world, which was very, very difficult, I lost my reputation. I lost my reputation. I lost my job. I lost my ministry. I lost support from my church congregation. Everything. And there was a time where I felt like, God, you've got to restore my reputation. You love me, you should restore my reputation. That is a false idea of God, mm-hmm. right? Because of what I wasn't seeing was God was taking away those edges, right? In order for me to connect more with him rather than mm-hmm. put me in this horrible system, right? That I wanted to hold on to. Mm-hmm.
And Jill, when he takes away those edges, it's very raw.
Very raw.
So then you're more, you need him more.
You need him more, yeah. right? You need him more. And so, and you do have this decision to make. Am I going to go toward him more, or am I going to pull away? And in my case, there were months when no one spoke to me. It was devastating. And I would say to God, no one from my congregation. My neighborhood supported me. I would say to God, what are you doing? What's this silence? And now I go, you know, I laugh and I think, he was saying, Jill, I'm here. So I did begin to think, oh, if I just do lots of good extra stuff, I will show the world that my reputation is okay, right? Mm-hmm. And honestly, I won't tell you the specifics, but the things that people thought about me when I heard about them were horrible, absolutely horrible. And I thought, wow, you could think that of me and you know me. That's mm-hmm. amazing. Mm-hmm. That's very hard not to fight against. Mm-hmm. And yet what God was doing in me was much greater than trying to establish or reestablish a reputation. But that's what Job is trying to do, right? I'm going to show you that I'm good, and God, you can't possibly, I dare you to do this again. You can't possibly do this again to me. His second flawed thinking is that God sometimes works against order, that he acts like a chaos creature. He thinks if God doesn't have a reason for his choices, if God isn't governed by justice, if God influences human lives with his power, then he's got to be a chaos creature and he's got to be the author of disorder. It's not true, right? God is the author of order only. It may seem like disorder to us. It may seem like chaos to us, but God knows what he's doing. The example would be that I would blame God for what's going on in my life. I would blame him to say, you're bringing disorder, which is what Adam does, right? Adam says, you've brought disorder in my life. And what does he consider disorder in his life, Adam?
Eve.
Eve is disorder in his life, right? You're the cause of me feeling shame. And I'm sure God wants to say, well, yeah, I am actually the cause of you feeling shame because I want you to come back. Shame is that signal to come back, not to go away. So it's that blaming of God for disorder. And thirdly, God does not always do what is right. That's Job's flawed thinking. Job feels that God's not going to assess his case honestly. And so Job basically sets himself up as judge over God's policies. Your policies aren't right, and I'm telling you they're not right. I'm going to hold you accountable, God, because you're irrational. You're not coherent. You're not making sense to me. What he does is he assumes that there's a standard outside of God. And we often do this, right? If God is not being this, then things are wrong. But God is the standard. And we flip that. We continue to flip that.
It happens all the time.
Yeah. It happens all the time because whatever we need or desire at the time, we decide that attribute has to control everything. Mm-hmm. But his attributes don't control things. He controls all
People
things
say that
through
all the
his
time,
wisdom.
How can a good God allow
yes.
a bad
yes. yes.
How can a good God found yes. bad things to
death? Yes, that's exactly it. And that's what Job is doing. So what Job's testimony does for us is it exposes how thoughts go awry in the midst of crisis. Sometimes those are hard for us to imagine. I can't imagine me thinking that about God. And literally, I spent hours trying to think through, what does it look like? Because if you're not in crisis, your thoughts are fairly consistent. But you get in crisis, right? And all of that comes and you don't know how to think. But let's think of it this way. If we understand why we misconstrue God's nature, then I think we'll say, oh, I probably then do that. We misconstrue God's nature because we believe our righteousness, our relationship with God, earns us special consideration. You think we feel that way?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Of course. What is it, the prayers of a righteous person?
Availeth much.
Yeah.
But what does that mean? I feel like I should have special consideration because like Job, I actually live close to a place where I hear him all the time. And because I hear him, I honor that. And you might be hearing a sermon on Sundays or hearing his word every day as you read his word. And I honor that privilege of hearing his word. And I do all these things. And so it should be cohesive this way, right? Letting me define what cohesive looks like. It's like expecting your relative to get you a job. So my son-in-law, Ben, his uncle, up until last year, was, what's the right, Donna, what was Tim?
Assistant
superintendent of District 203. So Ben is a teacher, but also Tim's daughter is a teacher. And Tim refused to help his daughter get a job in District 203. And we all go, what? We would expect that, right? Mm-hmm. It's your daughter. She had to move to another state to get a job. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't help her? But that's what we expect, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're the dad. You should do that. We expect that of God. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing.
We perpetuate that idea, too, because I've heard people say, like, oh, will you pray for my son? Because God hears your prayers.
Yeah. Like, yeah, yeah.
What?
Yes.
Where did you get that idea?
And we mean God will answer you what I want.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Intervene for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Righteousness, yeah. Our relationship with God is an end. It's not a means. Mm-hmm. That's where we're to get to, is to have a relationship. We don't have a relationship so that we can get a job, so that we can get what we want. Our natural response should be righteousness. I want a relationship with him because he's God. Secondly, we misconstrue God's nature because we prioritize coherence over God's reputation. And this is big. All of us want life to make sense, mm-hmm. right? All of us, we don't like these taking away of our edges at all. We want it to make sense. And we want it to make sense so much that when it doesn't make sense, we are willing to rail against God and say, God is not fair, God is not good, God doesn't know what he's doing. Because it doesn't make sense to me. And yet, when it comes to the little things of life, it's okay. It doesn't make sense to me how electricity works.
Right.
But I'm okay with that.
Mm-hmm. I still control this phone. I don't know how it works.
Yes.
But I got control.
Exactly. And that's the problem we have, right, is I don't have control over God's idea of coherence. And remember, his big picture of coherence is big. Where he's going is big, and I can only see this little piece. I will then have more concern for my own reputation than for God's reputation. If things don't make sense in my life, then others might not see me as good, see me as having a relationship with God, see me as whatever I want them to see me as. And that unnerves us, right? How many of you have ever been in a position where your reputation has been maligned and you are, like, been maligned, not in something you did, but something somebody else did. And you're just like, I got to fix this. How can I fix this, right? It feels like chaos. It feels chaotic, doesn't it? That's where Job is at. And God wants him to know, I got it. Like, I know what I'm doing. Why are you so worried about your reputation when you're not worried about my reputation? So when we think about that, we need to prepare our thinking before we encounter suffering. We need to remember God is for us and God knows what he's doing. We need to know that the process of going through suffering can be healthy. That process of wrestling with God is honest and good. It can expose disorder in our thinking. My theology change in my suffering, when my reputation was thrown to the wolves, my theology changed for the good. It can create, like Cindy said, rough and raw edges where God can connect his life to ours more fully. When my reputation was tanked, my character changed for the good. I became more compassionate. I became much more vulnerable because I couldn't hide anymore. Yes, my life is a mess. Here I am. Here's the thing we need to remember. Not embracing a good reputation isn't the goal. God used Job as his star witness, knowing that his reputation was going to be ruined. And that's when he used God. He knows that his purpose is going to be shown in Job's rough times. God uses us in our rough times, not in our polished times, not when we have a nice border. He uses us in the places where we can connect to him. And those are always going to be the rough places. Those are always going to be the raw places. His purpose is for the restoration of good creation, leading to Sabbath space. And if he can't be seen restoring us, if we don't need restoring because we've got these nice shiny edges, God isn't seen as a God who restores us to good creation where there's space for Sabbath. I want you to do one last thing. I want you to take a puzzle piece. It's just these little cutout pieces. And I want you to write on them. You know what? Maybe I'll do this. Just take a puzzle piece. I want you to write on one side, when life is not cohesive, or when life doesn't make sense. Maybe that's the easier one. When life doesn't make sense. And on the other side, God knows what he's doing.
We're actually writing those exact words.
Yep.
Oh, okay. I just didn't know if it was supposed to be like a personal.
Oh, when, if no, you want it personal, you can. No. You can.
So what were the two things?
When life doesn't make sense, or when life is chaotic, or when life is not cohesive or coherent. And then on the other side, God knows what he's doing.
I mean, the actual event, like something you didn't understand.
No, you're writing those words.
You're just writing those words. Oh, sorry.
It didn't make sense.
Oh, okay.
God knows.
I want you to write these words.
Thank you.
When life doesn't make sense, write that on the back. And on the front, write, God knows what he's doing. This is the idea that the narrator is getting through with the wisdom poem. And then what we see Job not doing. It doesn't make sense to him. And he just can't imagine God knows what he's doing. But the rough edges, those edges of the puzzle, are the places God can connect his life with yours. He can't connect them on the smooth edges. I like that picture because none of us like raw edges, but I love puzzles. And raw edges mean the puzzle can grow, right? Let's end with our verse, Job 42:2. I know that you can do all things, and no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Let's end with our prayer. Almighty God, to whom all hearts are open, all desires known, and from whom no secrets are hid. Cleanse the thoughts of our hearts by the inspiration of your Holy Spirit, that we may perfectly love you and worthily magnify your holy name. Through Christ our Lord. Amen.